Hi, everybody. My name is Deshu Galati. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be here. Grateful to be sober tonight. And I want to say thank you to Billy for having me come out or asking me. I'm one of those people that have been raised in AA to say yes to any AA request. I've come to believe that I can't do enough for Alcoholics Anonymous to repay it for what I've gotten and what I have and the life that I live today. So I'm really glad to be here. And my sobriety date is October 17th of 2002. I have a sponsor and I have a home group. And those will be the three most important things you'll hear come out of my mouth today. The rest is just my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. But those three things are the foundation upon which my recovery is built. I don't believe that I would be here without those three things. They're vital to my recovery. I have a sponsor who guides me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and gives me an objective view of my life. He doesn't micromanage my life. He doesn't make me do anything. But I am emotionally invested in the decisions that I make. Even at almost 17 years sober, I think I have some really good ideas. And you'll hear in the next 45 minutes or so that they're not really good ideas. And so he just gives me that objective view. And I have a home group, which is the meeting that I'm accountable to. I'm there just about every Sunday night, except for tonight, and once a month, my wife gets to go to the meeting. Since we've had children, we had a little custody battle over the meeting, and she got 1 week, and I got three, so I still win, I feel like. But I've had service there since I got sober, and people know me, right? It's my safe place. It's my home base in AA. It's the place where I go, and people ask me how I'm doing, and I say, I'm fine, I'm good, I'm okay. And they look at me, and they're like, really, what's up? You know, because I don't know if there's anybody else in here, but I still have an ego problem, and I would rather look good and let you know that I'm dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I will go to the mat to help somebody, but when it comes to asking for help, man, it is still torture. You know, it's like nails on a chalkboard. I do not want to do it. And but these people know me after all this time, and they can call me on that, which is, it's comforting. And I have my sobriety date, and any chance I get to speak, I say this, it's the date that my life changed. You know, I do not believe that we are special in any way as alcoholics. We are all God's kids, alcoholic or not. But we are blessed that we get to live two different lives in the same lifetime. We get the one before Alcoholics Anonymous, which is pain, chaos, suffering, and misery for us and the people that love us. And then if you come here and you do, and you're willing to do what's outlined in this book and the program of action, you get a life that's promised happy, joyous, and free. And that has been my experience. And that is for us and the people that love us, right? I joke about it all the time, but really, I say my mom and my sister became two of the nicest people in the entire world after I got sober, you know, and it had absolutely nothing to do with them. They were just as nice as, you know, they were amazing people before that, and I just didn't realize it. So if you get nothing else out of what I say tonight, I hope you get that I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe it's divinely given. I believe it's the greatest thing on this planet. It has transformed my life and has transformed the lives of the people that I care about most in the world today. And it's an amazing thing. I live an abundant life today because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't mean that in the material sense. I've had things and I have some things and I like things, right? Material things, but those come and go. But what I talk about is that the relationships in my life and the inner life that I have today are far beyond measure and anything that I ever thought that I could have before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. So my job tonight is to tell you what I was like, what happened to what I'm like today. And I will tell you that alcoholism affected my life from a very young age. My dad was an alcoholic, and we were living in Minnesota. And I heard my mom crying one night. This is when I was about, I guess, fourth grade, 10 years old. And I heard her crying, and I go out, and it's in the middle of the night, you know, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, something like that. And I hear her crying, and I go out, and there she's there with a couple of police officers, and I asked her what was happening, and the best she could, she told me that daddy was dead, and I didn't know what was happening, and I didn't understand it, and what had happened was my dad had committed suicide. My dad was an alcoholic. He tried Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a 30-day chip of his, I have a 60-day chip, I have a 90-day chip, I have his 12 and 12, and I have a 24-hour day book that has phone numbers in it. You know, I even have a medallion from a rehab, and so he tried, but for whatever reason, he didn't get it. You know, shortly thereafter, we moved to Rockville, Maryland, and my mom provided everything that she could, you know. But it was an upper middle class white community, and I can tell you, I just didn't feel like I fit in, right? it was this, you hear it in the rooms all the time of Alcoholics Anonymous. People don't feel they feel different, right? And I can tell you, I was a short, fat Indian kid with one parent whose mom drove a copper Pontiac station wagon, and I wore Garanimals, right? Now, the flip side of that is everybody else was predominantly white, had two parents. Their parents drove Mercedes and Toyotas, and they were wearing polos and Izods. So it wasn't very difficult for me to tell you that, you know, it's like I have my fourth grade picture that proves that I was different, right? It's like, where's Waldo? Right there, you know? And that's how I felt. I just felt different. But like I said, you hear that in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous all the time. And I sit in rooms where, you know, I don't look like everybody else. And the majority of the people to me look the same. And I'm like, really, you guys feel different, you know? And what that means to me is it's not really what's on the outside. It's how we feel on the inside, right? It's what we feel on the inside. And those are the reasons that we drink. And I took my first drink when I was 15 years old. It wasn't a big deal. I can tell you that I didn't think of anything at the time. It was, we were walking home from school, and I was with a few guys, and we found a six-pack of beer laying in the park on the way home. Some guys must have, like, gotten scared off or ran or whatever. So these guys took it, popped the beer open, took a sip, and then said, here, have some. Now, I never thought about drinking, cared about drinking. It wasn't on my radar. It was just not something that I was interested in. But at that very moment, my mind said, if you don't do this, they'll never ask you to do anything ever again. And so I drank. Now, I didn't get drunk. I mean, I took the first sip, spit it out. It was warm beer we found in the park. It was pretty disgusting. But we finished that six-pack, and I didn't get drunk that day. But what I have come to believe is that I triggered the allergic reaction, right? I put beverage alcohol into my system, and I triggered the allergic reaction. The first thing was the obsession of the mind. For the next 2 weeks until I went for my first keg party, all I did was think about alcohol. I wanted to know what it tasted like, what it smelled like, what the big deal was, why everybody talked about it. I started to pay more attention to the Absolute magazine ads. And I went to my first keg party, and I remember having the red cup. I remember going to the keg. I remember having the first beer. And then I remember waking up the next morning. And to me, that's the phenomenon of craving, right? You hear it all the time. You drink until you run out, pass out, or black out. I do not drink socially. You know, I don't understand drinking socially. And then for the next 17 years, alcohol pretty much ruled my life. You know, it took me places that I never thought I'd go to do things I never thought I would do with people that I wasn't raised to do them with, you know. But what alcohol does for me, it doesn't do for everybody else, right? It doesn't do for 90% of the population. Alcohol changes my perception of the world, right? But more importantly for a guy like me, what it does is it changes my perception of the way that I think that you think about me. Right? And that's important to a guy like me because I drank for acceptance and I drank for effect. It changes the way I feel about me because I can tell you from as far back as I can remember, I would look in the mirror and I hated what I saw, right? Because I didn't see what I saw when I looked at you guys. I wanted to be taller. I wanted to be skinnier. I wanted to be whiter. I wanted to be more athletic. I wanted to be sexier. Whatever it was, I wanted to be anything but what I saw in the mirror. And when I drank, everything that I used to compare myself to you got washed away. All the inferiority, all the insecurity got washed away. It leveled the playing field, allowed me to look you in the eye, and allowed me to be okay. Now, it doesn't do that for everybody else, right? There was a guy that I used to listen to when I was newly sober that he talked about when he drank, it made him feel like other men looked. And that's what I understood that. I understood that deep down, right? Because my examples of being a man, like, were Fonzie and the Marlboro Man, right? I didn't have any other. I didn't have a dad. My dad wasn't around. My uncles and my grandfather didn't, you know, we moved to Maryland and nobody really did anything. I didn't have any male role models. But when I drank, I could feel, I could stand taller and I could feel like I was a man, you know? And so I love the effect produced by alcohol. I love it. And the thing is, the difference between me and the normal drinker is that the normal drinker will drink alcohol as a beverage, right? Now think about that really for a second. Like I can say that, but think about it. They drink alcohol as a beverage, Like, they think it's the same thing as coffee, tea, soda, and water. That, right? It doesn't produce the effect to them that it does on me. And you, if you're in this room, probably, right? It does something to us that's the elixir to life. It allows me to breathe deeper, allows me to sit in my seat, allows me to be okay in the world. And to them, they drink it to quench their thirst after mowing the lawn, right? The nice, hot, cold Corona. Like, or this is the one that gets me. They drink wine to enhance the flavor of their food, right? Like, they get pairing menus at restaurants. Like, have this wine. It'll taste good with your fish. You're like, seriously? Like, I don't – that doesn't make any sense to me, right? I need it to live okay. And you guys want to make your food taste better. So like I said, for the next 17 years, like, alcohol ruled my life. I grew up in the 80s, which I swear contributes to my alcoholism in some way. I was an awkward kid. It was an awkward time. You know, I don't know if you guys saw this movie, 16 Candles. There was this character named Ducky. And so I was the Hindu Ducky. I had bangs. I had a rat tail. I had earrings. I wore a thin black leather tie, blazers, peg leg jeans. And I wore this to school, right? I was a cross between, like, Don Johnson and Billy Idol. A bad, bad scenario. And I got picked on a lot, right? I got picked on a lot by the jocks and the preppy guys. And so what I did was I ended up hanging out with a bunch of my mom's friends' kids, a bunch of Indian kids. And we used to run around and have house parties and stuff. And somewhere along the way, I worked in a moto photo. Now I'm really dating myself. It was a film developing place. You know, they used to have film. And I figured out how to make fake IDs, you know, using their equipment. So I would make fake IDs, and I could get the beer and wine. And I met up with the one Indian kid that did drugs. So we hung out together, and we had this reputation. And, you know, I would bring the wine coolers and the beer to the party. The girls would like me because I had the wine coolers. The dudes would hang out because we had the beers. And I had this reputation, and I loved it. But I didn't have a lot of friends. So I didn't. I did this, and I was, you know, alcohol afforded me this reputation, right? And so I go through high school, and I'm pretty miserable, and I don't try very hard in school. I don't need to. I'm getting good grades. And what alcohol does for me, this is the prime example of, like, kind of what it does for a guy like me. So my senior year, my mom wants to send me on a trip, the senior trips to Rio de Janeiro. And she, you know, single mom, and she saved her money and wanted me to have this experience. And so we put down the deposit, and I see the list of all these people that are going. And it turns out to be all of the jocks that have been picking on me for 3.5 years. I'm like, no way. I try to get my money back. They don't give it to me, so I have to go on this trip. And now I'm terrified, right? I'm going to be in a foreign country with little to no adult supervision. And I'm thinking I'm going to get my butt kicked up and down the beaches of Ipanema by these guys the whole trip, right? So we take off, we get on the plane, and we take off, and I'm in the middle seat, of course, in between two of these dudes, and I know these guys, right, from high school, from junior high and everything, but high school changed the groups, started to form, and, you know, and we start talking, but we take off, and the stewardess comes by and asks us if we want anything to drink. And I don't know, like, again, I don't know if it was the 80s, if it was international water, whatever it was, we started ordering liquor, and we just started drinking. And I will tell you that the next 10 days were glorious, right? I'm drinking with these dudes every day, all day. We're, like, you know, we wake up in the morning, we're drinking at breakfast, we drink throughout on the beach during the day, at night we're going to clubs, and they weren't carding us, and it was amazing. And on Monday morning, we get back 10 days later, I'm going to go to my side. I pull into the parking lot, and I'm going to go to my side where the losers hang out, you know? And they go like this, and they waved me over. And you hear in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous all the time that feeling, that moment of, like, you have arrived, right? And I will tell you, that was that moment for me. Alcohol provided me the opportunity gave me the power to do what I couldn't do on my own, right? It allowed me to be with the people that I thought I wanted to be with, doing the things that I thought I wanted to do. And I talk about this a lot. There's these pinnacle moments in your drinking, right, where everything lines up perfectly and you don't overshoot the mark, right? And it's that feeling of, like, utopia. It's like that feeling inside of, like, this is why I do it. It's like the sky opens up, the sea parts, and, like, this heaven sing, and it's like, this is the feeling. This is it. This is why I do what I do, right? And now the problem with that is for a guy like me, is that feeling comes far and few between, right? That feel, because I overshoot the mark all the time, right? I don't have a gauge on where that is. But that feeling comes, it comes often enough to allow me to keep going, right? And it allows me to keep going into what it talks about in her book, into the gates of insanity or death. And for me, obviously, I'm standing here, so it wasn't death, but it would happen any time that I felt like I was having enough or this is it, I've got to stop. I would hit that moment, that pinnacle moment again, and everything would feel right. So I graduated high school, and I ended up going to the University of Maryland. And I was a commuter. I commuted for the first year, and I had a hard time fitting in because all my friends had moved to the dorms, and so I hung out at the student union, where a bunch of these Indian kids would meet up and in between class, what happened was my drinking took off to another level because I didn't have anybody watching me, right? So I didn't have to, again, I told you I didn't have to try very hard in school, and at least in high school, and then I kind of skated my first year in college, and so I started to drink a lot more. And what happened was I started to become somebody that I wasn't before. I started to cheat on girlfriends. I started to get into fights. These guys asked me to. These guys were breaking into cars and stealing radios and radar detectors, and they asked me to come with them. And look, I didn't need the money. I didn't need to do this. I wasn't raised to do things like that. But it was this situation of like, if they wanted me to log, and if I said no, that they wouldn't ask me to do anything ever again. So I started to break into cars with these guys, and I got my first arrest shortly thereafter. And what happened was I started to drink. I was drinking so much and becoming this different person that that these Indian kids that I had known for so long, these friends of mine, just started to get sick of me, right? And I told you I was behaving in ways that I wasn't raised to do, and I was becoming this different guy. And so that Indian kid that I was hanging out with that was doing drugs introduced me to a bunch of guys that were in the fraternity. And and so I was getting tired of arguing with all these Indian kids, and so I just figured, well, I can join the fraternity, you pay them, you can drink as much as you want, and they have to be your friends. So I thought, they don't have to be your friends, I can tell you that. but you can drink as much as you want if you do it right. And so I started pledging this fraternity. So this is my second year now. I'm in college for my second year at the University of Maryland, and I decided to move off campus. I was living in an apartment with my old high school buddy, and I'm pledging this fraternity, and I'm going and I'm pledging this fraternity, and I'm driving home drunk a lot to my apartment, and I go, and I'm not proud of that. I mean, I drove drunk a lot, and I'm not proud of it. I am ashamed of it. I'm just glad that nothing happened, and I think we have to be careful sometimes because people try to tell funny stories about drinking and driving. And I think you got to be careful because you don't know who's in the room and whose life has been affected by a drunk driver. So I just say all of that to say, I did it and I regret it. But I ended up driving home that night and I'm at my apartment and my mom calls and she lives in Rockville. So from University of Maryland to Rockville is about a 30, 40 minute drive. And she calls me at like 1 a.m. And she says, I'm sick. I don't feel good. Can you come home? And I'm like, I can't. I told her I can't. And she calls me back 1 hour later. She says she's thrown up and needs me to come home. And I tell her I can't. Call me back again, and I could barely lift my head off the pillow. And I mumbled something into the phone. Next call I got was about 10 o'clock in the morning, and it was my uncle. And my mom had a heart attack. And I didn't get to the hospital until about 1 o'clock that afternoon. I couldn't do it. And I get to the hospital and I walk into the ICU. My whole extended family's there. My sister's there. And I don't look good. I don't feel good. I don't smell good. And I'm met with the look, And the look is that look of like when somebody, God, when they look at you and it's like, how could you? Or why did you? Or you did it again. Or you promised. you know, and they look at you with this look that just kind of cuts right through you, right? And the answer isn't, screw you, I want to drink, right? That's not the conscious decision that I'm making when I'm doing these things. That's not the answer, but that's what it is, right? And but the despair in their eyes, right? And they just don't know why or how you could be how you are. And I mean, I know that feeling deep down in my soul too, right? And that feeling to me is that feeling that it talks about in our book. It talks about it in a different way, but it's that feeling of incomprehensible demoralization, right? That feeling, you know, that... And I can't summon up an answer that would be adequate enough, you know? And so my mom was in the hospital for a while, and I only went to see her a couple times. And I was convinced that when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, for all those years, I was convinced that the reason I didn't go see my mom in the hospital was because I was terrified, that I was scared. I was scared she was going to die. I was scared that I was going to be alone. It was going to be me and my sister, and I was not going to know how to be. And I just didn't, I couldn't bring myself to go. But what happened after coming here and getting down to the causes and conditions of my drinking and doing all of the step work that's involved with that, the reason I didn't go see my mom was because I was still pledging that fraternity. And I thought that if I didn't show up at those pledge events, that they wouldn't have me. Again, it goes back to that acceptance, right? I drank for acceptance and I drank for effect. And what happened was, you know, that's the guilt and shame that I bring into Alcoholics Anonymous, right? That's the guilt and shame that I drink over. And what it is so the best way I can describe it is like, I don't think that God makes bad people. I think we do bad things, right? Some things happen to us and bad things happen. But what happens for me with my alcoholism is like, if I'm going to use this analogy, if you take a pencil and draw a line on a piece of paper, right? And then you take the eraser and you erase the line, you're going to know that that line was always there. It never completely fades away. You'll know that it was on that piece of paper. And to me, that's sort of like that line between right and wrong, right? I know the difference. We know the difference between right and wrong. But when my alcoholism, my alcoholism starts to take hold, that line starts to fade, right? It fades and it fades a little bit more and it fades a little bit more. And then the more I'm doing these things, that wrong becomes right and right becomes wrong. And I'm hanging out with people that are doing the same things that I'm doing, right? So the alcoholic, like it talks about, the alcoholic life is the only one I know. So now I'm just living this life and I'm not even thinking that I'm doing anything wrong. And in that process, I'm hurting the people that I care about most in the world, right? And that's what happens to me when my alcoholism takes hold. And so I ended up getting into that fraternity, and then I got kicked out of school because I wasn't really going to school. It was drinking. So this is the great idea that I had. I was going to community college because I got kicked out of the regular college. I was going to community college, but I was paying my fraternity dues so I could still drive back up to the University of Maryland and drink on the weekends at the parties, because that made a whole lot of sense. During that time, I started to hang out with some other guys, and I fell in love with the Grateful Dead. So I grew my hair long, started following the Grateful Dead around. I became a businessman. I always try to like make it sound more glamorous than it was. I became a drug dealer, and so I started dealing drugs. But this is what was happening. I grew my hair long because I wanted to be a hippie. But what was happening was I had all these different groups of friends, right? And my alcoholism and my was taking off. And so I would hang out with my hippie friends, and I'd wear my hair down and wear my Birkenstocks and my tie-dyes, and we would do our thing. And then when they started questioning me, I would pull my hair back in a ponytail and slick my hair back, put on a blazer, and I'd go out to the clubs in D.C. like Fabio, right? So I would do that. I would wear my baseball hat backwards and my fraternity letters and my duck boots and hang out with my fraternity brothers. And I just would go from group to group to group, right? And nobody would – I would stay long enough where nobody could question how bad I was getting. But I was dying inside. I knew that I was dying inside, you know, and I knew that I couldn't stop it because it was the only thing that was making me feel good. It was the only thing that was getting me through life. So I got back into the University of Maryland, and I ended up graduating. And after that, a bunch of my friends ended up moving out to Colorado, and I sort of felt alone, and I moved back to Rockville, and my business career kind of took off a little bit more. Started growing marijuana, and I had a lot of disposable income, and I was just going down to DC, and I started to meet a bunch of people, and I started to get to know the right people, and I get to be behind the velvet rope, as they used to say, right? I used to get to the VIP sections and do all that stuff, and shortly thereafter, I moved into Adams Morgan, which is a part of DC where two streets meet, and it's literally lined with bars and restaurants. And I was right on the corner. I had a view of the Washington Monument out my back window, and I had everything at my disposal in my front window. And I got a job as a copy boy in an office, and it wasn't a very strenuous job, and it afforded me the opportunity to live the way I wanted to live. And what happened was my drinking took off to another level, right? I had graduated college, and the only thing by the time I got down to DC, the only aspiration that I had, right? It wasn't about career. It wasn't about family. It wasn't about anything. The only thing that I wanted was to be able to go to a bar, order the usual, and have the bartender know exactly what I meant. That's how high I was shooting. Like, that's it. And I ended up getting that in a couple different bars. And what would happen was I would go to work, and I would be so hungover that I would be able to go in, and I would do. So what I did was I convinced myself that if I ever called in sick, that I had a problem. So I never called in sick, no matter what happened, whether I stayed up all night or I was, no matter what, I would still go to work, and I'd get to work and I would do what I needed to do. And there were times where I would go, and when I was working the copy boy, I would go into the bathroom stall, and I would sit in the bathroom stall like I was going to the bathroom, and I would fall asleep. And I didn't think that there was a problem. I just thought I was tired. I ended up after that getting a job through a friend of mine at a huge international organization downtown. It's the kind of job that you don't get fired from, 5 weeks vacation, full pension. Like, you know, it's a dream job. And somehow I stumbled my way into it. It was when the internet was taking off, and I took some classes, and I was able to get the job through this friend of mine. And my mom was so proud because it was like there was prestige in this organization and all this stuff. And I was doing well for a while. You know, things started to change, and then I met the it's funny how we as alcoholics end up finding the people that we really shouldn't be hanging out with, you know, and anywhere we go. And I found these guys that were in this organization that were partying like the way I did, right? And we just started to run around DC, and so I had an office at this place, and so what would happen is I would drink all night, sometimes stay up all night using outside issues, and I would go to work, and I had this office, and I had these set tasks that I had to do on the company's intranet, and some other stuff that I had to do every morning. And so I could go in, and I would do those things, and by 10:30, 11 o'clock, I could shut my door, and I would sleep under my desk. And then I would get up, and I would go down to the cafeteria, and it was an international organization, so they served beer and wine in the cafeteria. And so I would have whatever I needed to take the edge off, and I would make it to about 4:30 when I could go to happy hour. And that's the way I lived for a while. And it got so bad that there were points that I knew that I needed to stop. And we were just talking about this in the car on the way here, that there were times that I wanted to stop so bad. And I put post-it notes all over my house that said no more. I put them on the door, in the bathroom, on the bathroom cabinet, in the refrigerator, on the telephone, on my bed, on my computer. They were all over the place. On the front side of the door, on the back side of the door. So when I came home, I would see it. When I left, I would see it. And I would come home. And there were times, I can remember there were times I would last 10 or 15 minutes. And it was just unbearable to me. And I would pick up the phone, and I would call the Chinese restaurant that delivered beer and cigarettes. I would never order food from the Chinese restaurant. They'd deliver beer and cigarettes, and I would order the beer and cigarettes, and then I would call the drug dealer, and I'd have the other stuff delivered. And And that's what I would do. And I would tell you, if you asked me at that point, at any point during that time in my life, I would tell you that I was changing my mind. That's it. I was just changing my mind. But there's a part in our book where it talks about that we drink not because we wanted to, but because we needed to. And I didn't realize that that's what was happening to me. That's what had happened. That I no longer had the power of choice. That I needed to drink to stay alive. Right? I needed to drink to be okay. And what happened for me was on March 28th of 2001, I woke up with those four dudes hanging out on the edge of the bed again. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. Like they always, like every morning woke up like the same thing. And it was like, okay, you know, here we go. It's going to suck again, right? And what happened for me was I just realized that I thought that my life sucked, and I learned to manage the suck, right? My relationship with God at this point was, you're not going to make me quit like you made my dad quit. You can do anything you want to me, but I'm going to pick myself up, I'm going to dust myself up, and I'm going to give you the finger, and we're going to keep going. We're going to keep fighting. And that day I went to work again. And around lunchtime, I got a call from security, and they wanted me to come down to pick up a FedEx package. And now this is an international organization with about 5 or 6 building campus. Each building has a mailroom, so I intuitively knew that security doesn't deliver FedEx. So I thought something was wrong. They wanted me to come down to the main building to pick up this package. And I went down to the main building, and outside the front doors of the main building of this organization, the DEA arrested me for a conspiracy to distribute MDMA, commonly known as ecstasy. It says right across the front of the indictment. And I went from being whatever I thought I was, club kid, club star, drug dealer, whatever. I don't even know. I couldn't even tell you what I thought I was at that point, to being literally the worst turd in the toilet bowl, you know? I had no idea what I was going to do with my life. I mean, everything just went. And I had to go home and tell my mom that her son was a drug dealer. And again, it's that feeling of incomprehensible demoralization, right? She didn't raise me to do those things. And so for me, it was, what happened was I fought that case for 18 months. In that 18 months, my sister postponed her wedding 3 times without telling her fiancé why. And the reason was we weren't going to be able to tell anybody why the eldest male in my family wouldn't be able to attend the wedding. She called me the most selfish person she's ever met in her entire life. I hit her back with a profanity-laced tirade that ended with, "You don't understand what my life is like." That's the selfishness and self-centeredness that I bring into Alcoholics Anonymous. I, when I'm in the midst of what I am, I don't care about you. And in December of that year, I was driving home from a Christmas party, got pulled over, got a DUI a mile from my house. So I could have gone to jail while waiting to go to prison. and I didn't think alcohol was a problem. I still didn't think it was a problem. I thought it was a case of bad luck. And I didn't drive for 30 days. I had people pick me up and drop me off. And I continued to drink. And what we would do is, since I had to leave that job at the international organization, I had to resign because the ethics committee frowns upon getting arrested for dealing drugs. I started a business with a friend of mine, and we would work out of his apartment. And then it looked something like this. It was, I would go there at 4. I would go there early in the morning, 9 o'clock in the morning on a Monday. We would work from about 9 to 4. And this is one of the guys that I had started to party with at the organization. We both left. He left for other reasons. But I would work with him until about 4:30. We would go down to the basement of the apartment complex and get a case of beer. We would drink that, and then we would go to the clubs in D.C. And I was still drinking like nothing had ever happened. But I think that I was slowly trying to drink myself to death, right? I didn't. But now that I see it, I think alcohol actually kept me alive long enough to get to Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Because if I didn't have alcohol and I was faced with going to prison and what my life was going to be like and all of those things, I might have done what my dad did. So I fought that case, and then I started to pray. I started to pray to a God that I really didn't believe in, because what I saw from God was, I watched my mom pray every day of her life. Both her parents died when she was young, when she was in India. Both her sisters, when she was young, passed away when she was in India. She came here with her brother-in-law. He passed away. Her husband committed suicide, and her mother-in-law died of lung cancer, never drank or smoked a day in her life. My mom had a list of health conditions that included congestive heart failure. She had a quadruple bypass. She had rheumatoid arthritis. She had kidney failure. She had glaucoma. She had edema. I mean, I can go down the list. And I watch her pray. And I was like, if this is what you get in return for prayer, thanks, but no thanks. You know what I mean? Prayer can be for the people in the Bible Belt because they live on farms and they don't have, this is how belligerent I was. They don't have movies, theater, clubs. They wake up every morning with a cornfield and they have to pray to God to get through the day. That's literally how I thought about God and religion. At one point I was down in Adams Morgan, I double parked my car to go into a liquor store, and the Mormon guys with the white shirts and the badges tried to stop me to talk about God. And I walked by them the first time because I was not going to get into it with them. And then they said something on the way back, and I decided to have an argument about the existence of God with these two guys who were like all about God. And while I'm watching a cop give me a parking ticket for double parking my car, I was just belligerent. I hated it. I couldn't stand religion and God, because at that point I thought they were the way I looked at it was that they were the haves and the have-nots. And all the haves would talk about God and how great God was and help them and blah, blah, blah. And the have-nots were people like me, you know? And I was convinced of this. But I decided to pray to this God that I didn't believe in because I didn't want to go to prison. Like, you know, it talks about in our book, like a child makes a list for Santa Claus. And I prayed and I prayed and I prayed, and then I had to plead guilty, and then I was right. God didn't work. So I had to turn myself into the federal penitentiary in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, on October 17th of 2002. And I got there, and it was a boot camp program, and it sucked. they shaved my head. They gave me army greens and combat boots. And, you know, I had so much ego that I thought they would look at my file and see that I was a college graduate and I worked for this organization, and I was going to get some sort of treatment. I don't know what I thought I was going to get, but I can assure you that when you get to prison as a drug dealer, they treat you like an effing drug dealer. And that's, you know, we would wake up at 5 a.m. and we would do physical labor. We did PT, physical training. Then we would do hard labor. Then we would do chow. And then we would do either class or hard labor. And then we would eat again. And then we do PT again. And I mean, you get from 5 a.m. to 10 p.m. it was rinse and repeat, kind of over and over again. After we ate dinner every night, we had to march for 2 hours. And the first couple Friday nights I was there, I saw these people. I would march by the window, and I saw these guys sitting in a circle. So I finally decided to ask them guys what they were doing, and they said they were in the A meeting, and they said, you should volunteer. I said, why? They said, you get to sit down. I said, okay. So I went to the drug counselor, and I had filled out my intake form, I guess, from the drug counselor. They give it to you, and I said, I'd like to volunteer for AA. And she said, oh, you were going to go to AA. I guess I passed the intake. But I joke about it all the time, but I went to my first meeting there, and I've been sitting down ever since. I actually even volunteered for Al-Anon for Thursday nights so I could sit down. I'm an alcoholic, but I'm not stupid. So I started to go to these meetings, and again, like you heard, I was just trying to get over. I wasn't trying to get sober. I didn't care about AA. I was just trying to get over. And what happened was an elderly woman, an elderly man came in. The man had an oxygen tank. And they came in without fear for their safety into the federal penitentiary to bring us the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can assure you that if those people didn't do that I wouldn't be here today. I've been lucky enough to do area level service, the chair of our area intergroup, and some other things. And I have listened to people. I've listened to a man who's 6'7", 250, say that he wouldn't go into juvenile. He wouldn't take a meeting into a juvenile detention center because he was afraid. And that's fine. He can be afraid. That's no big deal. It's up to him. You can do whatever you want. But I can tell you that if it wasn't for this elderly, defenseless elderly woman and elderly man with an oxygen tank coming into this prison because they knew it was the right thing to do to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I wouldn't be here today. So, again, none of us really cared. We were trying to get over. It was during the first Middle East War. And during the sniper shootings, I don't know if anybody remembers that stuff down in Maryland way back a few, well, I guess it's a long time ago now. But we didn't have any contact with the outside world. We had one 15-minute phone call. That was it. No radio, no television, no newspaper. This boot camp was lockdown. So she would come in and we would ask her a bunch of questions and she would make us have an AA meeting. And so I sat there and a few weeks passed and I said, well, I finally asked her. I just didn't get it. I said, what makes you an alcoholic? Now, I described to you the phenomenon of craving, the obsession of the mind, and the doctor's opinion in our literature 100%. I believe that is the definition of alcoholism today, through and through. But she said it to me like this. She goes, what do you do when you get envious? What do you do when you get jealous? What do you do when you get angry? She said, you slowly commit suicide while the other person isn't thinking about you. And I said, holy, right? I drank at people my entire life. My mom, my dad, my sister, my girlfriend, your girlfriend, the cat, the dude behind the counter at the 7-Eleven, the person that cut me off in traffic, whatever it was, if you made me mad, screw you, watch this, and I'm at the liquor store, I'm at the bar, and I'm drinking at you. And it talks about it in the 4-step and the 12 and 12, beating ourselves up with a club of anger intended for somebody else. And I was like, holy, you know. And I went back to my bunk that night, and I wrote my mom a letter, and I said, I don't think I'm ever going to drink again. And I took this prayer, and I took the Serenity Prayer, and I changed it, and I tried to pray to this God that I didn't believe in again. And I said, God, grant me the courage to change my life, the strength to do it, and the wisdom to know it's the right thing to do. And I prayed that prayer, and I prayed that prayer, and I prayed that prayer. I got out of that prison, and I got into a pre-release center. And I can tell you, I was 6 years sober, and I was telling the story, and I realized it clicked while I was at the podium telling the story that prayer had been answered. Because I was in that room telling that story sober. It took me a little while to figure it out. But... And now I'm a firm believer in prayer. I believe that every single one of us is here because somebody prayed. Mother, father, brother, sister, uncle, aunt, cousin, girlfriend, boyfriend, somebody prayed and we're here. And if you don't believe that, that's fine. I'll believe it for you until you can, hopefully. And I got out of that place and I got to this PRC and they told me that the pre-release center and they told me I had to go to 3 meetings a week. And I said, no, I'm alcoholic. I understand. I'm going to go to one. They said, no, you're going to go to 3. You're going to go back to prison. I said, okay, I'll go to 3. Again, I'm an alcoholic. I'm not stupid. And I started to go to meetings. And I'll tell you that you people were crazy. I would listen to people talk about going to jail sober, sleeping in their car sober, like all of this stuff. And I'm like, you guys are nuts. Like, absolutely not. I am not going to – no. Now, mind you, I am property of the federal government still. Right? I have an ID number that distinguishes me as their inventory, right? I have a federal prison number, so they own me. I'm living in a place where they tell me when I can come, when I can go, when I can eat, when I can sleep, and I have to piss in a cup just to stay. And I'm going to judge the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what I bring to you guys, right? And what happened for me was there was a guy who I used to drink with who found out through my business partner at the time what my situation was, and he got in touch with me, and he had gotten sober. And he said, you know, so I gave my number to my business partner, and I started to call him, and I asked him, I needed a sponsor to get a home pass, so I asked him if he could temporarily sponsor me, and he lashed out at me. None of this temporary BS, you know, all this. I'm like, dude, calm down. Like, why are you talking to me this way? And what he did was he came, I went back to work at that guy's apartment. The business was still viable after I came home, and he would come and bring me lunch and read the big book with me. Now, that's cool. And then he pointed me to where my home group is, right, and the people in my home group. Now, that's fine and good and all, but it turned out that he was actually not sober when he was doing this. He was drinking, but he knew enough about his time in Alcoholics Anonymous to reach out and help me. And he got sober again for a little while, but he ended up passing away from our illness. And I can tell you, if it wasn't for him or that elderly woman or that elderly man giving of their time and sacrificing for a guy like me, that I would not have the life that I have today. And so I ended up going to these meetings and I meet my other sponsor, and I start to go, and I didn't get to Alcoholics Anonymous and be like, woohoo, I found my people. You know what I mean? I was not happy, but I kept coming. And what happened was I got out of the PRC and I got home, I had a ankle bracelet on, and I didn't know what to do because I had clients. I didn't have friends, right? And the only thing that I had were these numbers of these people in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I started to call them. And then around, I got the ankle bracelet off, and I had this plan, man. I was going to go back to the clubs, and it was bottles of Cristal, and it was girls dancing on tables, and it was back to the old life. And what happened for me is that night that I got that ankle bracelet off and I was free, man, I ended up going to the movies with 50 members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Literally 50. My home group was 400 people, so there was 50 people, no exaggeration. And I ended up driving a dude home at midnight that lived 30 minutes opposite of where my house was. And I didn't drink that night. And around December of that year, I was crying. I was praying, and I was crying every morning, and I told my sponsor, I was like, I'm out of here. I can't do this. This isn't working. And he's like, you have no faith. I said, what are you talking about? I found God in prison. Like, I was a guru now. And what he meant was that I wasn't, I didn't have any faith that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous would work for me. Because I really wasn't doing anything, right? I had an ankle bracelet on. I had 15 minutes before the meeting, and I had 15 minutes after the meeting. So I was coming to the meeting, I was eating your cookies, drinking your coffee, listening to your message and saying thank you very much, and I was going home. Now, there's a saying in Alcoholics Anonymous, and don't get me wrong when I say this, don't misinterpret it, please. Meeting makers make it. Meeting makers make it to a lot of meetings, but if that's all you do, you're not changing, right? That's, you're going to the meeting. The book talks about this, you know, the character change sufficient, the steps are designed for character change sufficient to relieve the obsession to drink. So if I'm not doing the steps, then I'm not changing. And it also tells me that if the same man will drink again. So if I'm just coming to the meeting, drinking your coffee, eating your cookies and leaving, then I'm not going to change. Then I'm destined to drink again. And that's why I was miserable. So I ended up getting 3 service positions in 10 days. I started driving people all around Montgomery County in Maryland. And my life literally changed to the fact that people in my home group were calling me the happy Hindu. I was on fire. Right. And that was great. And everything was great in an AA for a long time. And then, you know, and then life happened. Right. Life happens. Which is sober or not, life happens. And that business that I had formed ended up, it failed. Now after, well, I guess it was 5 years, it failed. My mom had gotten sick. The AA girlfriend that I thought was going to marry left. I had no money and my car died and I'm miserable. I ended up working for a friend of mine, and it took me, this is another, please don't misinterpret this, it took me a hard lesson to learn that God doesn't care what we do, he cares who we are. But I ended up working, my biggest fear when I got arrested was what I was going to do with the rest of my life. And I was afraid that I was going to be the guy behind the counter at a gas station, that I was not going to be anything more than a cashier at a gas station, and the Indian guy behind the counter at the gas station, right? And so... My friend owned a gas station, and he offered me a job because I needed one, so I took it. And then the first day, he takes me, and he shows me what I have to do, and he takes me into the bathroom and shows me how I have to clean the bathroom. And I'm like, wait, you want me to clean a public restroom? And he said, yeah, it's part of your job. And I was devastated, right? But what I failed to realize at that moment was 3.5 years before that I was cleaning bathrooms in the prison for free. My ego had gotten so big in that time that I had gotten sober that I thought I was above all that. The next day, I'm in that bathroom, and I'm in more emotional pain than I can think of, drunk or sober, and I'm on my knees crying in the bathroom. And I was really glad I cleaned it, right? But I got a call from a guy that I used to sponsor. He was coming out of rehab, and he wanted me to sponsor him again. Then 2 other guys asked me to sponsor him, and at this point, I'm chairing this big committee to bring the Young People's Conference to the state of Maryland, and we have a dance, sponsoring a dance down at Sessions by the Sea, 3,000-person AA conference in Ocean City, Maryland. And I do not want to go. I do not want to go and be around your happy people. But I had to take this kid. And I had to take him. And I come to the realize that God doesn't care how I feel. Because at any given moment, I can feel like crap. He cares what I do. Right? And so I took this guy down there, and he caught fire for a little bit. And he ended up staying sober for a while, but he didn't. And he's gone. But I did. You know? And sometimes that's how it works. Now, that scenario of losing my job, girlfriend leaving, relationship ending, whatever you want to call it, my mom being sick, having no money has happened 3 other times in sobriety. Never lost a job while I was drinking, but I've been laid off 4 times in sobriety. And every time, it's like, every single time, 3 guys ask me to sponsor them. And I'm like, God, I want I want a job, I want some money, and I want a girlfriend. Why are we doing this? Like, I got it the first time, right? Because after the first time happened, I got 6 months later, I got the girlfriend to come back. I had gotten a better job. I had gotten a new car. My mom had gotten better. And I asked my sponsor, I said, so where am I putting my reliance? Because when everything was bad, I felt bad. When everything was good, I was feeling good. And he said, what were you doing then when it was bad? And I said, I was going to meetings. I was sponsoring guys. I was talking to you. I was praying. I was doing everything I was supposed to do. He goes, what are you doing when things are good? I said the same thing. And he said, there you have it. I said, huh? I was like, what? But that's the essence of the third step, right? I do what I do because I'm supposed to do it, and the outcome is not up to me. There have been numerous times in my sobriety where I have found the circumstances of my life personally objectionable to me. They are not okay. But it doesn't mean that God doesn't have a plan. So the third time I got laid off, I'm trying to figure them all out. Third time I got laid off, I was about to get married, right? April 30th, it was my anniversary. We're getting married on April 30th. My mom goes in the hospital on April 1st, around that time. She's in the ICU, and I get an email saying that, the business, this law firm that I'm working for, 50-year-old law firm, international law firm with multiple offices worldwide, is closing. Turn in your stuff tomorrow. And I'm about to get married. We're about to move out of the house that we've had for 32 years. We're getting married on April 30th, moving on May 15th. And I'm like, why is this happening, God? Why are we doing this? My mom got out of the hospital and needed 24-hour care. I didn't have a job. I got to stay with her. I got an interview, and I had to drive to Richmond for the interview, even though the job was located in D.C., and somebody from Alcoholics Anonymous, who never met my mom a day in her life, came over and sat with my mom, took care of her while I could go interview. I got that job, and they let me start the weekend after that I'm supposed to move. They gave me a month. They let me start that job after I was supposed to move, so I got to get married, move, pack up, and do all that stuff. And the last time it happened, my mom was in the hospital. I'm sorry. The last time it happened, I was having my first child, and I was like, I can't believe we're doing this again, God. You know, how am I going to pay the mortgage? I'm having my first kid. I got 2 months severance. I used to commute an hour and a half each way to work, DC traffic, right? And I get laid off. I get to spend the first 2 months of my daughter's life with her, my firstborn child, and I get a job that's 15 minutes from my house. And now that's cool and all too, right? But it turns out my daughter has special needs. And so when she was in kindergarten, I would have to take her to kindergarten through the county. And we wanted her to be around normally developed kids. So I had the opportunity to go pick her up from her school and take her to the other preschool. Or sorry, it was preschool. Take her to the other preschool and have lunch with her 3 days a week. Because I had a job that was 15 minutes from my house. I became a mama's boy after my mom. I mean, when I got back from prison, and I can assure you that I lived in my mom with my mom, and from my 30s, I was in my mid 30s to late 30s, single, living in the same room that I grew up in. And before I got arrested, I was buying a house because my mom's dream was always to have a house where nobody had ever lived in. It was built from the ground up, and I got arrested, and we had to turn down that house. We had to get the refund, and we couldn't do it. And then me and my wife were able to, after we got married, we were able to pick this house, and my mom got to pick the colors and do all this stuff. And she got to live in that house, and I got to make amends for that problem, that thing that I had done. And she got sick, and I, you know, the last couple months of her life, she got sick, and the last day of her life, she was in the hospital, and I went to the hospital, and I gave her a kiss on the forehead, and I said, you know, happy birthday, Mom, I love you. And she said, I love you too, and she was like, thank you for being here. And I left the hospital, and her heart stopped a couple hours later, and she passed away. And now, my mom's birthday was on February 12th. My daughter, my firstborn was born on February 11th, right? And it was a year to the day, a year after my mom had passed away. And so on February 13th, the year prior, I left my mom in that hospital, right? On February 13th, a year later, I was taking my newborn home, right? Now, that's interesting and all too, but my daughter has a heart-shaped birthmark right here. I don't know if that has anything to do with AA, but I know that has everything to do with spirituality for me. My mom passed away, and I would have taken, you know, after she passed away, I took I would have convinced my sister that it was okay to take her ashes to the Potomac and spread them. But in our culture, the last rite of a son is to take them to India and spread them in the Ganges. And I can tell you that I did that. And it was one of those spiritual moments of my entire life. And I say all this stuff to tell you this, that if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous and rooms like this and people like you and the men and women that took of their time to help a guy like me, that I would have missed it all. I'm forever grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous and the men and women that came before me that didn't come here and get theirs and leave. I've seen too many people get sober and think that they've got all their stuff and just go and take it and leave. And I'm grateful to the people that don't. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, please stay. This is an amazing thing. Your life will transform. If you've been here for a while and you're in and out, please stay. If you're here and you're not happy, joyous, and free, find someone that is and jump in their back pocket and do what they do, because you'll get what we get. It says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. That is the closest thing to a guarantee you'll ever get in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? So thank you for my life, and thank you for letting me share.
I'm Sam. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you.